Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried, and comrades, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, it's been a week full of tension. There's no doubt about it. I talked last week about the situation in West Asia, where you had multiple acts of escalation by apartheid Israel, where they bombed Beirut, assassinated leading members of Hezbollah. They bombed Tehran in Iran and assassinated Ismail Haniyeh, who's the chief negotiator of Hamas, the one who was actually interacting with them, you know, negotiating with them on a ceasefire. They killed him. And now the West, the entire collective West, is in panic mode, trying to prevent Iran from striking back, which is its legitimate right under international law, given that it was attacked by a hostile power. Now, and of course, Israel has done this escalatory thing the United States has not reined Israel in, even as it's trying to rein in Iran and prevent it from retaliating. against this outrage. It has done nothing to rein in Israel. You know, there's been no, apparently there's been strong words behind the scenes, but no change in policy. And instead, what you see is the United States sending aircraft carriers, missile defense, you know, a steady stream of aircraft and cargo ships and military vessels and all this to the war, to the region, you know, fighter jets, you name it, and they're all moving in to cover Israel to basically protect the apartheid state against any potential repercussions. I mean, this is really what's going on. I mean, this is why Israel engages in these kinds of actions, because it feels it has a guarantee the United States will back it up. You know, and it's willing to risk war. It's willing to risk, like, plunging the entire region into hell. Because it feels it has, the superpower has its back, you know. And will do whatever is required to protect Israel. You know, including risking full-scale war and the deaths of potentially millions of people. That's what we're seeing in the Middle East right now. That's what we're seeing, you know, this kind of brinkmanship, you know, by Israel. And meanwhile, the assault on Gaza continues. They just bombed, Israel just bombed another school with an American bomb, an American supplied bomb. Killed 100 people this time. It was a UN school, I believe. And this obviously isn't the first time. They bombed hundreds of schools. You know, they bombed hospitals. They've done all this stuff. There's nothing new here. But what this should be a wake-up call is all that rhetoric you see kind of coming from the certain Western leaders about ceasefires and things like that, and that Israel needs to show restraint. It's all lies. It's all PR. It means nothing. You know, they're not reining in Israel. They're not, like, cutting off the flow of weapons. Instead, they're piling all their military resources into the region to cover Israel and shield it from any repercussions of its own barbarous actions. Like, that's what we're seeing here, you know. And it's just, yeah, we need to understand what's really going on. Anyways, While that's going on, you know, like while you know, we're kind of waiting for this this Iranian retaliation against Israel, which probably will come in the form of some sort of missile strike, drone strike, could come at any time, like in the next few days, might even be happening now for all I know. But history moves on. The rest of the world is, you know, there's all kinds of things happening in the rest of the world. And there was one thing I was going to talk about last week. I didn't really have the time, but I've talked recently about what's been going on in Africa with, you know, the impressive resistance, the axis of resistance, which has opened up in Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, these places which have thrown at French colonialism. They've thrown out American neocolonialism. You know, they're forging their own way. You know, they're forming basically a confederation in the middle of West Africa. And they're forging ahead in their own direction, forming an independent course, both in economic and in political terms. But that's not all that's going on in that region. I mean, like, there's actually some incredible resistance going on in Nigeria right now. There's an entire people's movement going on in Nigeria, which is fighting back against what effectively is an American client regime, led by an extremely corrupt leader, who I believe owns the biggest fleet of private jets in all of Africa. And I believe this latest round of protests was actually kicked off when he tried to buy a new one at public expense. And the poor working class people of Nigeria basically had enough. They're in the streets. They're fighting back. And I want to play this next clip from Breakthrough News, which talks all about that. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Well, we want to turn our attention now to the West African nation of Nigeria. For those who have not been seeing, a wave of protest has swept Nigeria today, perhaps a wave of more protest over the coming days under the hashtag In Bad Governance and also Revolution Now. So a lot happening in Nigeria, and we are very, very honored to have here on the show to talk about this by David Hundane, who's a Nigerian investigative journalist and author. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. And let me just start maybe with some framing. Perhaps people saw some photos of protests coming out. But, you know, what are sort of the proximate issues that have ignited this protest wave there in Nigeria?
So there are multiple issues. There are sort of multiple subgroups that have sort of coalesced into a bigger protest movement. So, but the basic underlying issue that seems to unify everyone is the understanding that Nigeria is going through an unprecedented crisis of bad economics, basically. To put it in context, as at 2014, 10 years ago, Nigeria was rated as Africa's largest economy with a GDP of about $510 billion. 10 years later, Nigeria's population has increased, but Nigeria's GDP now stands at about $280 billion. So Nigeria's GDP has effectively halved in 10 years, while its population has gone up. So Nigeria's per capita income has more than halved in the space of 10 years. Already, it wasn't a particularly wealthy country in per capita terms, but now it's at disastrous levels. To put it in further context, of Nigeria's estimated 210 million people, about 135 million are estimated to be living in multidimensional poverty, which is about 65% of the country's population. So to put that in context, there is no other African country which has a population of up to 135 million. So that 135 million of Nigerians who are living in multidimensional poverty, that in itself is a population segment that is bigger than any other African country. So there is a huge groundswell of public anger to tap from. This is then further complicated by the fact that the new government, which came into power last year, which, as you may or may not know, is very much a US-backed government, has made absolutely no attempt whatsoever, as far as it is possible to tell, to create any sort of dent in this sort of ongoing economic disaster going on. And in fact, it is very much the case that the presidency and the executive arm of government seems even more determined to act as if the good times are rolling. So one of the stories that has caused a lot of controversy this year has been the decision of the president to buy a new presidential jet. To put that in perspective, the Nigerian presidency already has the largest presidential jet fleet in Africa, has a larger presidential jet fleet than many European countries. Bear in mind, this is a country with a per capita GDP, per capita income of roughly $1,500 a year, right? And at a time when there is a huge public finance crisis, an estimated roughly 80 to 87 cents of every dollar made by Nigeria is going on debt servicing, debt repayments, right? And at the time of, you know, austerity measures, because as you know, Nigeria has also had to approach the IMF and the World Bank multiple times. And the Nigerian Naira, that's the currency, has roughly halved in the space of a year in terms of its value against the US dollar. So about a year ago, it was roughly about 800 Naira to a dollar. Now it's about 1500 Naira to a dollar. And in the space of all of this, the president announces that his priority is to get a new Airbus private jet. The country then spends another 21 billion naira on a new residence for the vice president, who wasn't exactly homeless to begin with. So it then becomes clear to the people that it almost seems as if the government and the governed are living on two different planets, because on the ground, people are suffering in a very, very real, very, very visceral way. Suffering to the extent that even food, like actual nutrition, has become a problem. And it's something like 65% of Nigerian household income now goes on food alone, right? So that should give you an idea of just how serious this problem is. Like, this is not a hypothetical numbers problem. This is a very real problem. People are literally holding banners saying we are hungry. That's not a cute expression of discontent. That's a literal statement of fact. People are functionally malnourished because of how bad the economy is right now. And yet you have this sort of great big cavernous government, which sort of sits at a great height and almost seems as if it lives on a different planet to the rest of the country. So these are just some of the issues.
Wow. I mean, it's really important to understand all that context, given the fact that this is a very close ally of the U.S., this government in Nigeria, and is often touted as the way that an African country should be. And I'm just curious, when we talk about what's happening in Nigeria, has there been any perhaps influence or inspiration taken in what's been happening in the Sahel over the last year or so with all these different movements pushing out, you know, and new governments rising, pushing out the French and the Americans and basically trying to impose their own sovereignty on their countries. And obviously Nigeria has been used by the U.S. to kind of push back against that. But has any of those changes across West Africa influenced people's views about what they're able to perhaps do in their own country of Nigeria?
Absolutely. Absolutely have. So specifically, the coup, which happened last year in Niger, which is Nigeria's immediate northern neighbor, has had a definite impact, because I think prior to that coup, most Nigerians sort of thought of Niger as this sort of 37th state of Nigeria, not a very significant country in the eyes of most Nigerians, didn't really understand how it was even a strategically important country in geopolitical terms. And then the coup happened and the flurry of international attention that came with it. And then more importantly, the fact that afterward, Nigeria has since become Africa's top performing economy in the space of in the situation where it ordinarily is expected to be in chaos, is doing 11% economic growth, which is the sort of economic growth numbers Nigeria hasn't seen since maybe the 1970s during the oil boom, right? So that is then sort of creating a lot of questions and challenging a lot of assumptions, because some of the sort of successfully promoted assumptions in the Nigerian public space are that democracy, in the sense that it is promoted by the U.S. embassy, basically, is a precondition for economic growth and prosperity. Well, here we have Nigeria, which on paper is a democracy, has all the paraphernalia of a democratic state, has all the institutions on paper, has the Freedom of Information Act, has all the bells and whistles, even though functionally, it's Nigeria is actually classified as a hybrid authoritarian state, not a democracy, but it's treated as a democracy, especially by its foreign allies like the US. And people are starting to realize that, hey, these assumptions may not actually be true, because here, look at Niger, who we've never really thought of as consequential in any way. We've never really thought these guys are going anywhere. And all of a sudden, they appear to definitely be going somewhere. You know, you simply can't sniff at the fact that this is a country doing 11% annual economic growth. That those numbers are unfathomable to a Nigerian. So that definitely has raised some questions. And then almost as importantly, the events in Kenya, which have happened or are still happening almost concurrently, have also had a very outsized impact, because in both the cases of Niger and Kenya, even though the manifestations have been different, but ultimately it would seem as if the target of the anger has actually been sort of two sides of the same coin. So in the case of Niger, it's been a sort of direct response to perceived colonial interests and activities in the Sahel region. In the case of Kenya, it's been a response to the perceived neo-colonial actions of the IMF. And the fact that the populations of these countries have been able to so successfully, so visually and so successfully oppose these things and have actually seen some results has created a significant amount of expectation in Nigerian public space that, okay, so if Niger, this sleepy next door neighbor of ours, has been able to do something, bear in mind that in the aftermath of what the things that happened in Niger, as you rightly said, Nigeria was used, or the attempt was made to use Nigeria as a sort of blunt force instrument to bludgeon them back into line. And that simply didn't work. Nigeria imposed some of the harshest sanctions possible for a country to impose on a much economically less powerful neighbor. Nigeria blockaded Niger's borders. Niger's a landlocked country. They didn't have access to the sea. They were effectively cut off from global trade. Nigeria shut off their electricity, which was in violation of international law. Technically, Nigeria committed war crimes, you know, just to sort of bring them back into line. And at the end of the day, all this was to the net effect of absolutely nothing. The Nigerians are basically doing better than they were a year ago, as far as they're concerned, and are doing better than a significant part of the Nigerian population. And then the Kenyans were able to do their own sort of very visually successful resistance action. So these factors have sort of had a very outsized influence on the decision of Nigerians to come out and try to get something done.
You know, I think this is a critically important point here, touching on the sort of geopolitics of it. And I want to, you know, pick up on a point you made at the very beginning here of sort of this being a U.S.-backed government. And I know your own investigative reporting during the election was very much at the tip of the spear of some important factors. And when it seemed like, you correct me if you think I'm wrong here, the U.S. government was trying to help conceal certain information that could have had a significant impact on how Nigerians viewed the election and the vote. So talk, if you could, maybe about that specifically, but just in general, you know, what the United States is hoping to get out of backing the current government of Mr. Tinubu.
So for those who may not be aware, the current president of Nigeria, who came to power last year in the sort of heavily disputed election, that's the president of Bola Ahmed Tinubu, used to be resident in the U.S. and used to be a drug trafficker in the city of Chicago. He was active between the 1980s and the early 90s. And he was actually identified as a drug trafficker and as a money launderer, working on behalf of a heroin trafficking ring in Chicago by the US government. There was a multi-agency investigation involved in this investigation. So the IRS, the DEA, the FBI, and to a lesser extent, later on, the State Department and the CIA also got involved, because shortly after his involvement became clear, it also became, he had also started to have some involvement in Nigerian politics. So from the point of view of the US, rather than simply make this sort of mid to high level drug trafficker, international drug trafficker, pay for his crimes, I guess it was more expedient for the US government to use him for the purpose of international influence peddling, because this is someone who was at the time becoming more active in the Nigerian political space. Bear in mind, the U.S. actually has form for doing things like this. So you recall recently the former president of, I believe it was Honduras, was extradited to the U.S. on charges of drug trafficking. The story that I think is perhaps less told is that during the time when he was active as a drug trafficker or as a president with ties to drug trafficking, he was very much a U.S. ally, and the U.S. was very much aware of what he was doing. It was not a secret to them. You know, they have some of the best intelligence networks on the earth. So there's nothing that was happening that was a secret to them, right? And it was expedient to use him as a pawn, as a tool at the time. And as soon as he was no longer useful, then, you know, we got these headlines. So Nigeria is currently pretty much where Honduras was maybe a decade ago, in that it's being ruled by someone who is, for lack of a better term, an American puppet, right? A stooge, because this is someone who has the perfect sort of blackmail material being held on him by the US government. So, This wasn't entirely hidden at the time, because the results of the IRS leg of the investigation actually had some documentation in the public domain, which I was able to get hold of, and with which I was able to establish to a very large degree of certainty that this person who was running for president at the time has been at the very least indicted for heroin trafficking in the U.S. But then it quickly became very clear that the U.S. government was willing to do incredible things to keep this information hidden. So at the moment, I'm still in court with six different U.S. government agencies. So the IRS, the DEA, the FBI, the CIA, the State Department, and the Executive Office of the U.S. Attorneys. And there have been some incredible things that I have witnessed through the course of this FOIA lawsuit, where I've seen the U.S. government telling lies in court to protect a foreign criminal. I didn't know such things were possible. It's been a real learning process. And as far as it's possible to tell, it's clear that the U.S. government, you know, even from the wording of some of the privacy exceptions which have been used to prevent the release of this information into the public domain, there have been privacy exceptions that have been linked to national security. Somehow, it's in the national security of the U.S. to protect a foreign drug trafficker. Why and how exactly that is the case, I guess the U.S. government is the only one that can answer that question. So basically, that's where Nigeria is right now. Nigeria is being ruled by a foreign criminal of Nigerian descent who has backing, or who at the very least as recently as last year had the backing of the U.S. government. And it seems as if, based on that relationship that he has with the American authorities, he has been able to consolidate himself in power. And as you may have seen today, the sort of uprising against his very, very blatant misrule by the Nigerian masses has been met with incredible amounts of state violence. Usually when a protest like this sprouts, it usually doesn't sort of go up in flames on the very first day. But today alone, which is the very first day of the protest, no fewer than 11 people have been killed across the country. It looks like it's only going to get worse. And so far, it seems as if, well, the interests of the U.S. government do not really seem to coincide with those of the Nigerian people. So it would seem as if this fight, the Nigerian people are sort of we're in it on our own, basically.
Mm. Well, we will certainly continue to follow it, certainly through West Africa Weekly and your own byline as well. David Hundane, thank you so much for joining us here on the Freedom Side.
Thank you for having me.
There is suffering in the streets, in the streets. Our leaders say, let it be, let it be. We the people don't agree. For this suffering, there is no need. But they'll wait until there's a revolution, revolution everywhere. Burning of property, more homeless people lying in the streets.
So don't forget about your wealth. Won't you just get up and help before history repeats itself? Back to when? If you tired of the mind, if you want to change his master plan, won't somebody lend a hand? Back to when?
We the people cry in vain. We beg our leaders to show a little pity. For this suffering, there is no need. But they'll wait until there's a revolution.
They want revolution everywhere.
Burning of property.
More homeless people lying in the streets.
In the streets.
In the streets.
Our leaders refuse to listen.
They
say we the people cannot win, but we'll fight until we win, we win, and we will not stop complaining. No, no, no matter how many years it will take. No matter how many years it will take, no matter how many years it will take, no matter how many years it will take, we will fight to win.
So forget about your wealth.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Femi Kuti with Fight to Win, Nigerian singer, son of the legendary Fela Kuti, who fought against the American-backed Nigerian dictatorship for many years, while also being just an absolute superstar of Afrobeat. And his son kind of continues that legacy, you know, to this day, you know, and it's, you know, given what's going on in Nigeria now, you know, you see like a real tradition of resistance there in the music as well as in the streets, you know, these things go hand in hand. So anyways, I know I've really resisted wading into the American political situation for the last several weeks, for the last several months, actually. You know, for a lot of different reasons, you know, it's chaotic, it's a mess, and it's also just pretty discouraging to see, frankly, just how, you know, the level of corruption and ineptitude and just oligarchical situation and everything else, you know, like existing under the guise of democracy. You know, but I think, and I still don't really want to talk about it. That's why I'm going to turn it over to a pretty amazing commentator and one who's also rock solid in his solidarity with Palestine, Dimitri Lascaris, who is a former, he did run for the Green Party several years back. Unfortunately, he didn't win for the leadership of the Green Party, I mean, here in Canada. Planning on trying to take it in an eco-socialist direction, which would have been great. But he's been one of the most outstanding voices in Canada in terms of solidarity with Palestine. And he had a few words to say about the political situation in the United States right now with the presidential election upcoming and all that. So I'm going to basically turn it over to him. And there you go. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Good evening. This is Dimitri Lascaris coming to you from Montreal, Canada, with my latest rant of the week. Not surprisingly, my rant this week will concern the just announced withdrawal of Joe Biden from the 2024 presidential election. Now, I have a lot to say about this tonight, and I'm going to try to gather my thoughts and summarily present to you why I feel this merits an epic rant. I'm going to try to remain calm through all of this, despite the intensity of my feelings on this subject. And I'm going to start by going back to an op-ed that I authored in November of 2020. And this was a few days after Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump in the election and 2 months before Biden took office. The article in question, the op-ed, was titled "The King is Dead, Long Live the King." And you can find it on the website of Canadian Dimension, amongst other platforms. And in that article, I warned 2 months before Genocide Joe took office, our fellow progressives and leftists who were celebrating Biden's victory, that based upon Biden's interminable, extensive political record, there was absolutely no reason to celebrate at all. Now, I wrote a comprehensive review, or tried to offer a fairly comprehensive review of Biden's record, but I'm going to quote to you one part of that review, and it concerned the whole kit and caboodle. I looked at his attitude towards healthcare, towards financial regulation, towards the military-industrial complex, towards the whole question of democracy and so forth. I looked at racism, anti-racism, and I'm just going to focus in particular on one paragraph from the part of my op-ed where I was offering an assessment of Biden's highly extensive record, and that concerned war. And I wrote as follows: Biden is a warmonger. He supported Bush's criminal war on Iraq, and before that, the bombing of Yugoslavia. The NATO-led destruction of Libya happened while Biden served as vice president, as did Obama's drone-killing spree. In one of the debates leading up to this year's election, Biden vowed to make Iran, a country whose people have been devastated by U.S. sanctions, quote, pay a price, close quote, for the unsubstantiated claim that its government tried to interfere in the U.S. election, a claim for which there was really no proof whatsoever. During his presidential campaign, Biden assured the press that he foresaw no significant cuts to the U.S. government's stratospheric military spending. Indeed, within hours of his victory, defense contractors expressed confidence that Biden will preserve the status quo. So that was my quick and dirty assessment of Biden's extensive record on the question of war. And then I went on towards the end of the article and I wrote, in the final analysis, the best indication we have about the type of leader Joe Biden will be is the assurance he provided to some of his rich donors at a ritzy Manhattan fundraiser in June of last year. If he were to become the president of the United States, Biden told them, quote, nothing would fundamentally change, close quote. And I concluded my article by writing, mercifully, Trump has lost, but the profound injustices that empowered him sadly remain. Now, today, hours after Biden announced his withdrawal from the Democratic Party race, a geopolitical commentator whom I follow and for whom I have much respect, Arnaud Bertrand, I believe he's a French national, he comments extensively on America's hegemonic project and its friction and conflicts, in particular with China. And he wrote as follows today. Biden stands down and will undoubtedly be remembered as one of the U.S.'s worst ever presidents. Besides the obvious fact that his mind was gone, he unconditionally supported one of the worst atrocities in modern times in Gaza, helped trigger and fuel the biggest war on the European continent since World War II, with hundreds of thousands of dead, and he almost certainly gave the order to bomb Nord Stream, an act of war against Europe. On top of driving up tensions needlessly with China, trying to stop their technological development, and to impoverish 1.4 billion people, driving up the U.S. debt to insane levels, and in brackets, the president under whom interest rate payments on debt overtook the defense budget, and so on and so forth. And then Bertrand concludes his post with this sentence, all around disaster for both the U.S. and the world, a very dark chapter, yet another one in U.S. history. I could not agree more with every sentiment that he expressed. I'm going to elaborate now on why I agree. I'm going to start by talking about the Ukraine war. Now, in February of 2022, within a few days of the invasion of Russia having been commenced, I wrote an article in which I commented on both the legality and the inevitability of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. I looked at the cold, hard terms of international law, the UN Charter and so forth, analyzed the circumstances and came to the conclusion that this probably did violate international law. But on the other hand, I understood exactly why Russia was doing it, was not remotely surprised, and was absolutely convinced, as I explained in my article, that the West had provoked the invasion. The West knew for decades that the entire political elite of Russia regarded Ukraine's membership in NATO as a red line, as a severe existential threat to Russia. The communists believe this, the pro-Western liberals believe this, Putin's party believe this, the people to the right of Putin on the political spectrum, and yes, there are people to the right of Putin on Russia's political spectrum. Right across the board, as the current director of the CIA, William Burns, noted in a leaked cable, the entire political class of Russia was viscerally hostile to the idea of Ukraine entering NATO. George Kennan, one of the leading luminaries in U.S. foreign policy, warned about this in the 1990s. This was no flower. This was no person who was sympathetic to, a project of multilateralism. He was a U.S. neocon and imperialist through and through, but he understood the limits of U.S. power and said, if we expand NATO eastward, it will end in disaster. The entire U.S. political elite knew, as did the European political elite, Angela Merkel herself, when she was the most powerful leader in Europe as Chancellor of Germany, was unabashed in telling the American government, the Bush administration, that she was not at all comfortable with the idea of putting Ukraine into NATO because it could lead to a very bad place. So Angela Merkel knew it too. The entire European political elite knew, that Ukraine's membership in NATO would provoke a strong military response from Russia, very likely an invasion of Ukraine, and they did it anyways. They insisted on Ukraine entering NATO anyways, even though there was absolutely no goddamn compelling reason, not even one that was semi-persuasive, why we should expand NATO to include Ukraine. In fact, the whole reason for NATO existing disappeared at the fall of the Soviet Union. And there was a rich historical record that when the Soviet Union fell, Western leaders from Europe and from the United States repeatedly assured the leaders of the Soviet Union at the time of the reunification of Germany that NATO would not expand eastward. They could have stopped the reunification of Germany. Despite its weakness, the Soviet military had the ability to impede the reunification of Germany. But they peacefully let it happen, despite the horrors, the monstrous horrors that were visited upon the Soviet Union by the Germans and their other European allies, including the Italians and the Romanians. They, despite all of that, were persuaded, the Soviet leadership, to allow the reunification of this state, which had caused monstrous suffering to the Soviet peoples, far worse than the suffering that the United States endured. And despite all of this, despite the fact that the Soviets allowed the reunification to happen peacefully when they could have impeded it, and they were allowing the reunification of a state that had inflicted such pain and suffering upon them, despite the fact they'd been given assurances by the American government, successive Americans, leaders, and by leaders of Europe that NATO would not expand one inch eastward, despite the multiple attempts of Putin to try to work out some kind of a peaceful resolution to the civil war in the Donbass, which had been provoked by a U.S. orchestrated coup in Kiev. Yes, it was a coup. George Friedman, who at the time when he made the comment was the director of Stratfor, a national security consulting firm that is closely tied to the U.S. government, said shortly after the coup in 2014 in Ukraine that removed violently from power an elected Ukrainian president who was simply trying to remain on good terms with everybody, including Russia. He said that it was the most obvious coup in history. That's what he called it. So by the time you get to January 2024, or 22, I should say, and you see how the American government has reacted and what it knows about the Russian attitude towards NATO expansion into Ukraine, the only rational conclusion you can come to is that they wanted this invasion to happen. They wanted the invasion to happen. They wanted it to happen because they thought it would provide the perfect pretext for them to wreck Russia's economy. The 2014 sanctions they had imposed had not caused enough damage to Russia to destabilize it politically and cause the removal from power of Vladimir Putin, which was their ultimate objective. And why? Not because they care about his human rights record, but because Vladimir Putin doesn't believe that Russia should be a vassal of the West. They don't give a damn about Vladimir Putin's human rights record. They don't care what he does in parts of the world where they have no interests. They don't give a damn about any of that. They don't care about democracy or free speech in Russia. They couldn't care less about those things. All they cared about was that Vladimir Putin believed that Russia should be treated as a great power. So for this, he had to go, and they need to orchestrate a reason to destroy Russia's economy. And so they provoked an invasion of Ukraine. That's exactly what they did. And if you don't see it, you're still drinking and are drunk on the NATO Kool-Aid. It's obvious. It's obvious. So I laid this out in an op-ed in February 2022, while acknowledging that as a technical matter, the invasion probably did violate the UN Charter. Now, from the moment that I made that argument and began also arguing as the battlefield developed, and those of us who were paying attention could see that Ukraine was in serious trouble from the very beginning, and looking at the numbers, the difference in population, the sizes of the economy, the energy resources, the strategic resolve of Russia to protect itself from what it regarded as an existential threat, it seemed increasingly obvious to me and others back in 2022 that Ukraine was going to lose this war. It was going to end up destroyed. So I wrote about all of that. And how did people on the so-called left, you know, who claim to be anti-imperialist and be skeptics about the U.S. government to understand the reality of foreign policies, how did many of them react? Well, some of them, I must say, agreed with me without hesitation. They'd come to those conclusions on their own. They didn't need my help. But there was a sizable portion of the so-called progressive community which came down on me in a ton of bricks for saying the goddamn truth. That was the truth. I couldn't believe the level of abuse I was taking, including from people who claimed at some time to have been my supporters. It was mind-blowing. I thought the worst I had ever seen was the way people in the Zionist community came after me because I called for Israel to be held accountable, supported the BDS movement, accused Israeli leaders of being war criminals, accused Israel of running an apartheid regime. So I thought that was the worst I was going to ever see. But man, Ukraine took it to a whole new level of viciousness and absurdity. Absolute damn absurdity. And now what has happened? The architect of this disaster, who, yes, almost certainly did order an attack on the Nord Stream pipeline, causing the single biggest release of methane in recorded history, causing effectively the quite possibly irreparable damage to the German economy and other European economies by cutting off access to Russian gas, which is relatively inexpensive and affordable and reliable, and now increasing dramatically Europe's reliance upon LNG providers from the United States at higher environmental and financial cost to Europeans. What? How could people not see what was happening here? How could people not see that Ukraine, and to a lesser degree, all of Europe was being exploited and weakened in order to increase the United States government's control over Europe and potentially the world? That's exactly what was happening. And all of those clowns in Canada and the United States, those depraved buffoons, they followed Genocide Joe all the damn way. And then came the genocide in Gaza. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't imagine something worse than supporting, funding, fueling, arming a genocidal regime. That is the lowest of the low. That is the worst conceivable crime, both moral and legal, that a human being can commit. And that is what this damn President Joe Biden has been doing for 9 months, with the middle finger, his aging, crooked middle finger, pointed in the face of the world the entire time. He is a genocidal racist, a monster, and the man is unfit to be the manager of the local 7-Eleven, let alone to be the president of the United States. And shame on all of you people. Shame on all of you people who supported Joe Biden and who didn't see the truth. You're an embarrassment. But you know what? You can all rehabilitate your reputations by coming forward and publicly stating mea culpa. You were wrong to support the Ukraine war. You were wrong to believe that Joe Biden would be a better president than Donald Trump. You were wrong to believe the Democratic Party had the slightest interest in the well-being of the American people or in peace or in justice or in international law. You were horribly wrong. And the last thing I want to say about the Democratic Party is now is the time to put this party out of business. There is no entity on God's green earth that is more responsible for the fact that Donald Trump is likely to be the next president of the United States than the goddamn Democratic Party. They sabotaged Bernie Sanders in 2016. He would have been a much better candidate. To a majority of Americans, they would have seen him as being a much better candidate than the corrupt, neoliberal, megalomaniacal Hillary Clinton. But no, they sabotaged Bernie Sanders. The Democratic Party cheated Bernie Sanders out of the nomination. And then when Hillary lost to Trump, they concocted this preposterous theory that Russia stole the election from Hillary. And for 3 years, they peddled this nonsense. And the Mueller report revealed in inglorious color that it was all a pack of lies. It was a complete pack of lies done, amongst other things, to paper over the fact that the Democratic Party has sabotaged Bernie Sanders, who had a much better chance of beating Trump, because for all of his flaws, and he has flaws, Bernie Sanders is far superior candidate to Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And I think most American people would have seen that, and that absolutely horrified the elite, that this slightly to the left of center Democratic senator, Bernie Sanders, who isn't really a socialist at the end of the day, and he's not really an anti-imperialist at the end of the day, he's just significantly more progressive and leftist and peace-oriented than the Democratic Party elite, and they couldn't even tolerate that. So we got stuck with Donald Trump. And then Bernie Sanders ran again in 2020. And what happened in 2020? Obama basically orchestrated Genocide Joe's emergence as the leading candidate by telling all the other candidates who were dividing that part of the vote up to get the hell out. And he left Elizabeth Warren in the race, who was going to siphon off enough votes from Bernie Sanders to make a Biden victory inevitable. And what happens in the middle of the campaign? In the middle of the campaign, Hunter Biden's laptop surfaces. And the thing is just crammed full of ultra embarrassing and dirty and nasty videos and commentaries and emails. But the stuff that's most pertinent for purposes of the American people is there was significant evidence of Biden family corruption, potentially implicating the president himself. And what happened in the middle of the election when this laptop, this beehive of depravity surfaced and became known to the public? Dozens of senior intelligence officials came forward and claimed with a straight face that the laptop had all the hallmarks of a Russian disinformation campaign. And at the time that they made that statement, that preposterous claim, which the corporate media ran with to the fullest of their ability, the FBI knew that it in fact was Hunter Biden's laptop and had known this for months. The Democratic Party knew it. The leadership of the Democratic Party, and certainly Joe Biden, knew. And they all propagated this lie, which was only made possible by dozens of senior intelligence, so-called intelligence officials signing onto this letter. That wasn't a subversion of US democracy? Didn't they deprive from people information that might, in an informed sort of way, in a rational sort of way, cause them not to vote for Joe Biden? Of course it did. This was material information. That's precisely why they withheld it through their lies from the public. And the US intelligence community interfered openly in the 2020 election with the complete cooperation, complicity, and enthusiastic support of the Democratic Party elite. And these people tell us that they are the protectors and the guardians of democracy. So now, after all of that, it was revealed, of course, that it was actually Hunter Biden's laptop. It was revealed that Russiagate was a complete hoax, a paranoid delusion of the Democratic Party elite. It was revealed that they had cheated on Bernie Sanders in 2016. All of this stuff came to light. And in that environment, Joe Biden, this decrepit character who even back in 2020 and 2019 was showing distinct signs of cognitive decline, becomes the president of the United States and proceeds to screw everything up and set the world on fire. And that is why we are now confronting an overwhelming likelihood of a second Donald Trump presidency. The Democratic Party is responsible for this travesty, and the Democratic Party should be abandoned by every right-thinking progressive on God's green earth. Don't give them a cent of money. Don't give them your vote, no matter what bullshit they sell you about how they're a better alternative than the Republicans. As Joe Biden said back in 2020 to rich donors at the Ritz-Carlton, nothing would fundamentally change under a Democratic president. And that's my rant of the week, following Joe Biden's announcement that he's getting mercifully out of the race.
When the generator's on, till the cops said move along.